Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Rosemary Cook. I'm the director of Queen's Nursing Institute, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. I've just checked outside, and it's like a desert out there. So I think this is it of the 30 people who signed up to come in here this afternoon. We're it, which is good, because it'll mean that we can have a much better conversation. Now, it was suggested that for these sessions that we didn't use any slides and we just spoke very, very briefly and then had conversation. I actually have got a few slides just because I think it helps to put some ideas and sort of pictures in our heads, and then we can have that conversation. But first of all, who knows about the Queen's Nursing Institute? No? Good, right, good start. It's a charity. We're 125 years old this year, so we've been around a bit, but what we were set up to do was train district nurses in 1887. And we haven't done that since the late 1960s, which is why you won't come across us in that context. So since that time, we have been trying to fulfil those original charitable objectives, which were improving care of people at home in a variety of other ways. So we do a lot of things that we think help to improve care at home. And in fact, the nice free thing about being a charity that doesn't have a membership, or not a trade union, or anything of that kind, is that we can do whatever it takes to improve care at home. So that allows us to be very free. So a fair bit of it is about policy influencing and talking to the governments of England, Wales and Northern Ireland, but not Scotland, because there's a Q&I Scotland, about their policies and responding to what's going on, trying to shape them. And a fair bit of it is also about doing practical things on the ground. For example, we fund a whole lot of nurse-led projects, multidisciplinary but nurse-led projects, that are aiming to improve care. And from that, that gives me a lot of material to talk to you a bit about what we're going to talk about this afternoon, which is about acute and long-term care at home. So can I just check on you people in another way? How many of you are from acute hospitals or acute services? Right, one. Community-based services? Right, largely preaching to converted, I think, possibly then. And education?
Education.
Yes, and anybody else?
That's probably me. I'm a publisher.
Oh, right.
So I'm just hoping to learn about what you're doing.
Right, and what is happening? Okay. Well, that'll be an interesting conversation. I'll tell you a little bit then. But knowing that a lot of you have a lot of familiarity with community helps in how much we talk. So, just a quick reminder that I honestly think, in spite of all the rhetoric, and as we were saying, you know, we've been talking about this for 20, 30 years about moving care from hospital to community. I think the system is still largely seen like this, including by the very politicians and governments that talk about community care. They really do focus a great deal on hospitals and buildings and acute care, a lot on GPs, that's the pills being given out on the right, and in the middle is this very amorphous mass of things that are community services that are not terribly well understood, they're not terribly well commissioned, they're not at all well measured, but they're there and they do a lot of things. Patients, of course, don't see it like that. Of course, they're much more focused on themselves and the home. For them, I think community services are a bit more defined, because if you've got a health visitor coming, if you've got a small child, you know that. And if your elderly neighbour is getting a district nurse coming up the path to do a leg ulcer or something, you know that as well. So I think there is more definition around that. The GP surgery is, of course, still very important to people. And way in the distance is the hospital that, for many people, will never go near. A lot of people will go near occasionally in their lifetime. And some people have a bit more, but it isn't the centre of care. And all the talk and the policy has been about the home as the centre of care. And we've heard it all again this morning, and so it goes on. But it isn't at the moment, I think, a terribly real picture. At least not in policy levels. What is really interesting, the thing that the Q&I has, we get a lot of talk, we got big wide networks, we talk to lots of people, we visit lots of places. So we see what's going on, and it is so varied. And there are places where there isn't a great deal going on in the outside of hospital services beyond the very traditional, very hard-working community nursing services, lots of health visitors, all those sort of things happening. But there are places where actually things have got very, very acute in the home, and they are being treated as if their home was an admissions unit, a medical assessment unit, a pharmacy or an ITU. There are incredibly acute and complex and severe things going on in people's homes in some places. And the thing we haven't managed over all these decades we've been trying to do it is to make that the norm. And I think particularly a lot of stuff we heard this morning, but Peter from the Centre for Workforce Intelligence, he was talking about exactly that really, that the transition that we have got to make because of the financial situation, quite apart from any form of policy or politics in this, towards actually delivering a lot more care in the home. is looking at this kind of thing, where we don't just fiddle around the edges, we don't just improve. And his statistics were quite interesting, weren't they, in suggesting that we have upped the workforce a little bit, we've got more people doing different things. What we haven't fundamentally done is take stuff out of the hospital and do it in the home instead. We've added. Oh, sorry. So what does go on at home? Those who work around the community will probably be very aware of all of these things. There are places where you can get all of this stuff done in the home by people who are skilled to do it. IV therapy, chemotherapy, treatments of things that once would always have gone into hospital. MS exacerbations, cardiac and pulmonary exacerbations. I was talking to somebody just now about someone from one of the acute trusts who's a cardiac nurse, about the amount of cardiac heart failure care that is totally community-based. And it's particularly where telecare is in place, and North Yorkshire is a good example of that. They've got their heart failure patients using telecare in the home to monitor themselves, to start a rescue treatment, as it were, followed up by experts going in to help them in the home, which negates the need to go off into hospital. And they have really managed to reduce people's need to call 999 and go in. And when you talk to the patients or you read what the patients say about it, the key thing to them is confidence, for one thing, a sense that they're, and control for another, that they can do something when they start to feel ill, and that something actually works, and that somebody else is also on call, close at hand, who will come and help them with that. And when all that happens, they calm down and there isn't the same urgency. And you can imagine how scary it is for the relatives to somebody with someone with heart failure who's going off, who's clearly becoming breathless and anxious and panicked. Of course you'd ring 999, you can't blame them. But there are ways that we can prevent that kind of thing. Kids on parenteral feeding, again, children who would once have had to be in hospital because they're always on tube feeding, completely cared for at home. Ventilation at home, and I'll mention that again in a minute. Virtual wards is a concept most of you probably know pretty well by now, which is, you know, delivering almost everything you would in the hospital at home. I think you can debate that as a philosophical term. I don't actually like that particularly. I'm not sure that reproducing a way a ward works in a community actually acknowledges that the community is a very different place and a very different world. So I'd prefer a different term, but you know what I mean by it. And of course, terminal care, but not to the degree that people would like. And there's still a big gap between those people who say they'd like to be cared for at home at the end of life and those who actually manage it. And too often there's a point at which something snaps and that they end up being taken into a hospital or a hospice that where they might have preferred not to be. But the other characteristics that we see really clearly as we talk to people around the country is that community care is different everywhere. And it's really hard when somebody says, what's it like? What happens in community? Tell me about community nursing today. You really can't, because it's totally different in different places. If you've got, like me, family scattered around the country having experiences of healthcare, they'll all have a different one, because what's available at home is different in every place. When my mother was very poorly and needed IV antibiotics, she lives in Stafford, and you can imagine what that's like. I went to see her, and next to her was the Stafford Newsletter, our local paper, sitting on the side there. Headlines was about how many people die in Stafford Hospital. So of course they didn't want to go to Stafford Hospital. No IV service at home, so she checked her into a private hospital over the road. Paid a fortune for 4 or 5 days in a private hospital. Care was appalling. Well, care was non-existent. Dad did the caring, you know, nobody else did that. But somebody would pop around every 4 hours and give IV antibiotics, but it wasn't available anywhere else. And yet there are many, many places where the nurse would have come in, IV antibiotics would have been given, there'd have been no going anywhere, you know, much calmer, better situation. So it's different all over the place. And as the very first question somebody asked this morning about, well, show me the savings then, show me the money that you make if you move things into the community, is really hard, because it isn't necessarily cost saving. And I think behind his question was the fact that some of the evidence, some of the evaluations of these kinds of things have actually shown that it's about the same. It's different, it's in a different place, you're spending money on different things, but actually it costs about the same. It depends what you're talking about, of course, and that is part of the complexity of this, whether you're testing the sort of Evercare model of community matrons and dealing with those people who go in a lot, or whether you're testing a major telecare pilot where there's a lot of upfront costs. So it's difficult to say that this is necessarily going to be cheaper when you run any particular pilot. But like the North Staffs example, if you downsize your hospital and you save some beds and you remove some of the staff, you are going to save costs. But it doesn't just happen because you downsize the hospital. You've got to have something at the other end. And you'll be aware now, care at home, of course, is now run out of all sorts of different places. And this is a huge issue in many ways. It's an issue for knowing what's going on, knowing where the nurses are to speak to, and we as an organisation, you know, we try and talk to community nurses and their managers and service developers and commissioners to help them get the best possible care, but we don't even know where to turn anymore. These were the figures that the Department of Health gave about a year ago, April, so they might have varied since then, but at that point, when they did the Transforming Community Services movement, not the transform but the transfer bit, 27% of community-based services were off into acute trusts as their organising base and their employers. 28% mental health, 10% social enterprises, and quite a lot going to the aspirant community foundation trusts. So lots of variation, and that's apart from those people who actually deliver community services by being based in charities or independent sector organisations or whatever. So lots of variation in where it's all coming from. And largely, still, care at home is commissioned on the basis of either number of contacts that nurses have with patients, or sometimes even headcount, or occasionally, we're learning in some places, beginning to commission it on the basis of a care pathway. So the commissioner's actually wanting to know what they're going to get and then say, yes, we'll pay for that service. But many, many places are not, and they're doing it on the basis of 20,000 contacts or whatever. Well, going to see somebody is a contact, but it tells you absolutely nothing about whether you're doing anything useful for that person or whether there aren't other people who could have done with the visit who didn't get it. Some of the things that the patients say, this was particularly about telehealth, but in some ways it refers to, is similar to the feedback you get from other things based at home. The sense of reassurance, it feels like a godsend to have some control. So this bit about sharing things with patients and involving them, actually the patients like that. And it means a lot to go home. People want to be at home, generally speaking, or they want to get out of the hospital. So if you're going to do that, you've got to have services there to look after them. And the last one's interesting, that's about information rather than services. So this was a web-based forum. But again, information is becoming a real tradable commodity in community services, because for one thing, there's so much more available to patients. They find it themselves, they look it up, they read it, they can look on the web, they can know all sorts of things in very, very real time about their condition or about the possibilities or the treatments that happen somewhere else. And then they can debate that with the healthcare providers who go in. So that's a different relationship from when we held all the information and gave them whatever answers we wanted to their particular questions. But also, of course, information is real power in terms of looking after yourself and knowing whether you need to go near the service at all or not, because you found something out that you needed. So it makes a big difference on a very practical level to how much service is required. Four nice, easy C's for why we should be caring for more people at home. Cost is one of them, and as I say, if you do this on the grander scale, there is no doubt that it is cheaper not to have very big and expanding hospitals, but to have better community services. Capacity is another. The hospitals, well, there's so much more chronic disease and demand that you cannot meet it all through hospitals, unless we're going to commit to building more and more hospitals and having bigger and bigger workforces, which we're not. Chronic disease, those are the kind of things that need to be dealt with somewhere other than a hospital. You can't keep admitting people, you can't keep dealing with them. One of the things that I look back on now, I used to work in outpatients, and when I think about the way that we used to treat a lot of people with chronic disease, I'm absolutely appalled and embarrassed. And the idea that we expected people with something like diabetes or MS or whatever to come up to the hospital every 6 months routinely, see another junior doctor, go through the same round of tests, wait for hours to do it and queue up, and then go home again and do it all again in 6 months. I can't quite see why we did that now, because there's so much. This could be entirely home-based, all sorts of expertise, and there are lots of models out there now where people follow up. Inflammatory bowel disease is one of the earliest ones I heard about in Birmingham. They do it by telephone. Specialist nurses phone the patients, have that discussion, talk about symptoms, talk about management, and they do it at the time and place that the patient wants. If all's well or is manageable with some information, Bob's your uncle. If they need to come and see someone, they can do. And they see them in a week. They don't wait 3 months for an outpatient appointment. They see them really quickly, because they've dealt with all the people who didn't actually need to trek up to outpatients. So there's lots of ways to do that. Interestingly, it's not a very new idea, because those four things came out of William Rathbone's book of 1890. He was the guy who invented district nursing, and this was his rationale for why a good cadre of skilled district nurses was a good thing. But it could have been written by the government last week in their white paper. Same issues entirely. But we are in a different place now, and as I say, there is a huge amount of really exciting stuff going on, some very acute work going on in the homes, and the bits in the middle are really not the reasons that it happened. We didn't really choose to go towards home-based care. Policy, yes, they've been talking about it, but they haven't been doing an awful lot to match it. Is it chance? Was it an accident? You know, is it political? Well, there's little tiny elements of those things going on, but I think three things have really made the difference. And they're the three things that will take us over the hump from a bit of it here and there to actually we could change the way that we deliver healthcare. Advances in medicine technology, clearly one of them. I mean, it's not just the telemedicine stuff. The fact that people's operations could be done laparoscopically, that we're much better at anaesthesia, that we don't make people so ill after their surgery. A whole bunch of things have happened that mean that people don't need either to be in hospital or to be in hospital as long or to come out of hospital as poorly. So that's the one, probably the biggest change that there's been. But don't underestimate the changes to nurses' roles either. You know, we couldn't be looking towards a major shift towards care in the community if we hadn't enabled nurses to prescribe, to diagnose, to have confidence in the more advanced roles that they have, to delegate work to others. You know, all the developments in nursing have pushed us to a point where we could do an enormous amount more. But it feels a bit as if we've sort of taken down all the walls around nursing and what they can do, but we're still sitting in the middle of the cage, not really wanting to go anywhere. And there's only a few people who've kind of spread the wings and flown a bit, but fundamentally what we're talking about is dipping the cage. Like, you know, you take the cat to the vets and it won't get out of the basket. You end up upending it, you know. I think we're at the point where we upend the cage, really, and say to nurses, we have the capacity to do a huge amount more, but we haven't really used it. Now we've absolutely got to. Partly because of the other thing, which is the changes in society. And I think there's the information business, there's the degree to which people expect autonomy, to which they expect to be consulted, their capacity for partnership. We're a very different set of people than those sort of people in the 40s and 50s who sat in the new NHS, very grateful for what it would give, and very tolerant of a great big system that wasn't necessarily very easy to navigate, but that was okay because you were getting fantastic free healthcare from it. Now we're in a different state now, and we'll be in an even different picture as the years go by, and the sort of younger generation with a whole different viewpoint come forward. So I think those three are the main things. So what does that mean for reshaping the workforce? Well, there's two reports from the Q&I that, if you want them, they're on our website, which is really obvious. It's qandi.org.uk, and it's on there. Nursing People at Home, we issued last year. Lots of interesting things came out of that. Based on our campaign, Right Nurse, Right Skills, which is just what it says on the tin. Does the name Jamie Merritt mean anything to anybody? No? The day that we launched our Right Nurse, Right Skills campaign, which was in October 2010, there was a story in the newspapers about Jamie Merritt, who was a man who had been rendered quadriplegic in a motor bicycle accident, but was living at home. He was ventilated, lived at home in his bungalow, and community nurses came and nursed him and helped him. Unfortunately, on one occasion, the nurse who came couldn't manage the ventilator, turned it off, couldn't then turn it back on again, couldn't use the resuscitation equipment, and the man was then brain damaged. And I think there were two things that were really shocking about that story. The first thing that I think shocked a lot of people was the degree of disability and technological care that could be managed at home, because he'd lived perfectly well at home in that way for some time. And secondly, that there might be a situation in which a nurse would go in who did not have the skills required. And it was sheer chance that it was the day that we'd already decided on the name for our campaign and we actually launched it, but that was the point. You've got to have the right nurse with the right skills. You don't have a crash team at hand. You haven't got the other emergency rescue, so it matters much more. Equally, you don't have a CQC to come and investigate every home and see what it's like. The quality of care and the safety of patients absolutely rooted in the individual who's delivering the care. So we've got to get the individual right. So that was him. But what we say in our report, the things we've been looking at, the number of community qualified nurses, i.e. the district nurses with the specialist practitioner qualification, has been falling for 10 years. So a completely opposite direction from what you might think we need, while the number of healthcare assistants in the community has more than doubled in the same 10 years. So we know that the workforce skill mix is changing enormously, but it's changing in a way that doesn't quite match the picture we're after, which is much more complex than acute care delivered in the home. For some reason, this goes back to front. The second report we only launched earlier this month was called Smart New World, and it's about technology in the home. But interestingly there, 20% of the nurses that the RCN surveyed saw even the electronic patient record as a threat to the relationship with the patient. 82% didn't think telehealth would change nursing practice. Well, it jolly well ought to. You know, we cannot go on delivering things in the old way. Some nurses were criticising colleagues who worked on a telephone line, for example, thinking that's not nursing. It's not nursing if you're not in the room with a patient and touching them. And many people saying about technology, oh, well, that's an IT skill, having anything to do with computers and things. That's an IT skill, not a nursing skill. So I think that just illustrates that we have somewhere to go in preparing a workforce, our own workforce. And as the point's been made several times this morning, most of the people we're talking about in 10 and 15 years' time are already in the workforce. So it's not about what we teach the students. It's about where we go with our existing workforce. So what do we need to do? We need to know what is happening locally, and that is easy to say and really hard to do, other than at the level of local commissioners and local education and service providers. But it's ever so hard for any of the rest of us to get an overview, because it's different everywhere. So it really is a very locally focused issue. And then there's something about reshaping community teams to match these new ways of delivering care, and that means sometimes being quite radical and bold. And this has happened again in lots of different places, lots of examples, where they actually sort of stop and say, workforce planning doesn't mean if three DNs retire, we'll train three new DNs. You know, this sort of workforce planning is about thinking about what are we going to be doing, and like Liz Ricks was saying, you know, if the acute hospital is downsizing and which bits of that are going to be moving out, what care could be happening in the community, then those are the people that you need to develop, and you need to build your teams around what the patients need rather than traditional numbers or traditional titles. We really do need to reverse the dilution of the skill mix in the community, and that is the single one message that we have been banging on about as Q&I for quite a few years, and I don't quite understand why it hasn't got through yet. And I'm frustrated that this government can't seem to see that if we're going to get anything like the degree of movement of acute care into the community that they say is necessary and they say they're committed to, you have got to have skilled people there. And it's just like, again, like Liz was saying about her wards and the way that they've configured those teams so they've got quality and education built in, and they've got senior people and people learning and so on to make the quality on the ward good, and all those lovely graphs going in the right direction about the quality indicators they use, which aren't the right ones for community, we'd need something different. But you only get that by having the right teams. And so we've got to do something about the reversing the skill mix. We've got to do something about attitudes to technology. We can't have people saying, as and we've heard this in district nursing teams in places that shall be nameless, who were given laptops in order to do stuff in the patient's home that would wirelessly go off and update the record and save them driving to and fro and writing GP's notes and things like that. They sent them back because they didn't like them. We can't do that. You know, you can't have people saying, please give me a glass syringe. I much prefer the glass syringes to these terrible throwaway things. You know, life moves on. Care moves on, and we've surely got to give people care using the best instruments, not the ones that we're more used to. And fundamentally, it's about having the right nurse with the right skills for each service. And part of that is about involving patients in developing it. Again, partly because people have changed, they want that, they expect that, because they have a lot of knowledge, they have a lot of understanding. The whole expert-patient concept, of course, really works in community, because for most of the time, people live with their own disease and we see nothing of them. They, you know, they've got a huge amount to contribute to how you make it work. And it would be really good if we could get to the point of commissioning and evaluating the workforce and the workforce planning on the basis of outcomes for patients. We really cannot just do it on the basis of numbers of contacts or headcount of people. So, summary, it's a combination of all of these things to really make a reality, or to spread the reality of what's happening now, which is some very acute care going on in people's homes. It's a bit about how you design the services, a lot about technology, it's a lot about skills. Throw these boxes different sizes, they don't reflect the importance of what's inside them, just the length of the words. Skills are absolutely key. Never mind job titles and never mind traditional roles and all the rest of it. It is about the skills that are there. It's also about attitudes to make it work, about working with patients, and fundamentally really about having this vision that rather than just nibble at the edges and say we could do a bit of change, or we could have a new specialist nurse role who looks after this group of patients, is a fundamental change that starts from the fact that so much has changed in technology and in patients' roles and in society that actually we could start from the point that you will be cared for at home, and that after that, if there are things you need that we can't do there, then we'll make sure there's other bits of the system you go into, rather than fundamentally basing everything in the hospital, which I would say it still is, for all the rhetoric. So that's as much as I was going to say, and then what we've got is an opportunity to discuss it or talk about it. And if you want to know any more about any of those things that I've hurried through, then do ask.
What are the main barriers then that you perceive in terms of why this hasn't happened and why we're still here 30 years later talking about it?
Yeah. Oh, I think in recent years, which is the time when it could have happened most because of the technology, quite honestly, I think it's been about the fragmentation. And the scary thing now is that there really isn't such a thing as community services because they've been cut up into different bits in different places. The opportunity there, where it could happen, I think, is that while a lot of services were really anxious about being based with the acute trust, and feeling that they were going to be the bit where the money squeezed and the acute trust would be protecting the inpatient work and would be less concerned about protecting the outpatient. The other side of the coin there is you've really got an opportunity to have properly integrated services where they really understand what happens to the patient when they leave the hospital and conversely how much is going on in the home before the patient might need to come back in. So I think there are real opportunities there, but I think the fragmentation of the system and the constant change has been a real problem. And for any of us with a career that's been largely about primary care, it's really interesting. You go for a job these days and you list your previous ones, people want references and things. Most of the organisations I've worked for don't exist. I think there's only one, two. One's a GP practice, because they're still there all through the system. And the other's a Department of Health that can't seem to get rid of. Beyond that, nothing I've ever worked for is there anymore. Variety of health authorities, variety of community-based organisations, they're not there. You know. And that does make a difference. Because there isn't the same history, there isn't a sort of continuity, and there isn't a chance to build on something.
And is it about the inertia? I mean, people have referred to the will is there. I guess the critical mass of the people that are making the decisions, it just doesn't seem to transfer.
No, I think it's different at different levels, and I think we've got a real problem at the sort of middle level. I mean, the drivers are there in a sense from the department, from national policy and the government about getting care out of hospitals, saving money and so on. And what we see on the ground and very close to it and in the sort of working nursing teams is actually a lot of enthusiasm. I've said that we run a projects programme, we've been running it for 20 years. Every single year we get loads and loads of nurses coming and saying, I've got a good idea for a project, will you fund it? You know, and we get them in and we interview them and we pick the best ones and off we go. And I'm just amazed that they still come and they're still saying, I'm enthusiastic, I've got an idea. And they're prepared to do that extra work and all the trouble that goes with putting your head above the parapet and saying we could do things differently. So I think there is a lot going on there. It's really difficult for the people in the middle, the managers, the practice development people, and those are the ones amongst our networks who are losing their jobs right now. And a lot of the more experienced, the team leaders, the more the people who could make real change happen, a lot of those are feeling the squeeze, and then you don't get that impetus from there. So it's hard.
Do you think also that social care hasn't caught up with perhaps the nursing care? So you may have a nursing care in the community, but actually patients can't go home and stay. Somebody to come in and do the daily things for them, that because you have to pay for that, whereas you don't have to pay for nursing care. So
yeah.
Is that catch-22 where perhaps clients could be nursed at home, but actually there aren't those supporting.
That's the other
care.
Side of it. Yeah, absolutely. I should have mentioned that. That's really fundamental to it. And joining that bit up again is going to be key to making it possible, particularly when you think that a lot of it is about older people who are frail or have multiple conditions, and in a way we've got quite focused on individual conditions, and we've got good services for cancer patients, we've got good services for heart failure patients, and good things for people with MS and so on, and there's quite a mass of people who don't have any of those things conveniently, but they've got a bit of all sorts and they're quite poorly and maybe a bit the mobility is affected and so on. So those are the people where a great deal of social care is needed and maybe only a little bit of the other, and yeah, we have that complete problem that they can't go and get the social care package, they don't get that. Again, there are places where they're addressing that already, several around the country, but we funded a project in Stockport where the community nurses were going into a lot of older people living in flats, a lot, and it turned out that really it was not about health things at all. These people were really very lonely and had lost their confidence. They'd had a physical problem, complete loss of confidence to go out and do things. Well, they started recruiting volunteers. They got these youngsters going in and helping people to go out, go and shop and so on. And they had a huge impact. And they actually took them off all the district nursing books, and there was more capacity to see other people because they're actually meeting a social need, not a health need. And there are other social things like washing that are more fundamental than that even, of getting up or going to bed, that isn't, as you say, in the health gift at the moment. Whether local health and wellbeing boards and moving stuff into local authorities will help to solve that, I don't know. It's going to happen quite quickly. It needs to.
What's the difference between what they do in Scandinavia and what they do here? One of the speakers this morning gave some statistics about people going into hospitals compared to treatment at home, and gave stats for the, I think it was the UK or it might have been England, compared with Scandinavia. So what's the difference? What do they do that makes it work better than...
I don't know fundamentally, no. I don't. I was struck by that as well, particularly that I think it was 38% increase in hospital admissions in either England or UK, whatever he was referring to.
And
you think, how can that be?
I thought that was might be worth exploring.
I think it
find
is.
Find out what they're doing. And I was talking to somebody about it in the coffee break, and although they didn't know what went on in Scandinavia, they were telling me that in Finland, apparently you have sort of one nurse that can do everything, so they're a very highly skilled, highly trained nurse. Because, you know, you gave that list of nine things, sorts of things they could do at home. So in the UK, is that nine different people, or is that the same person doing the different things? It was one of your earlier slides.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
Talking about, the sorts of...
things you get in some places, yeah.
Let me just remind myself
what they were. Some of those will be specialists, and some would be spread. IV therapy, if it happens, is either in the whole community nursing team, or occasionally they've only trained one or two people, and that's where we go on about thinking about skills audits again. It shouldn't reside, that skill resides in one person who goes on holiday, then you don't have it available to your patients. If you're saying that service is available to patients, you need enough people there who can do it. Chemotherapy, I'm sure, is specialist individuals. The treatment of MS, that was an interesting one. Again, it was a project we funded initially. I'm sure it happens in other places too, in that it started from the MS specialist nurse, but she was then teaching the district nursing team. So some of this stuff might start as something that only a few people can do, but it ought to become the norm. If you remember giving IV drugs in the old days.
More and more of the community nurses, more and more to do without actually increasing the resources of the community nurses, so they're more and more stretched.
Well, then you need to, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
And that's the problem in that... with all the sort of early discharges and things like that, the money still isn't following into the community services for them to pick all that up at present at the moment. And so it's very difficult to pick any extra things up and make it. I mean, we do IV therapy at all, but if we get more than twice a day IV therapy, we're really pushed, because sometimes that can take an hour to do if you're doing it through an IV saline drip. That means 4 hours of your time people going in there and the money doesn't come out. Doesn't follow it at the moment.
No, that's what I was saying about the cost thing, really. You're absolutely right. And somebody mentioned about cost of transition this morning. Yeah, absolutely, because you'd have double running.
Exactly.
Of course, nobody wants to do it, because they're all trying to save their budgets. But you have got to build that team up to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's the bit that is the sort of big leap, rather than a few little bits here and there.
It does seem that little bits isn't working very much. It needs to be a big sort of culture change, whereas for me, it needs...
It's interesting on the local scale, wasn't it, in North Staffs when they were talking about that, because as you said, they were pushed by the fact that they needed their new hospital. And I used to work in North Staffs, so I know that health economy, which is, I'm glad they've got that, that's brilliant. But they knew they were having a smaller hospital, so that really forced them into getting stuff out of it and setting up other services. So there was some saving to happen there, because they were not funding as many beds. But you're absolutely right, in most places that doesn't happen. And I should have said, when you were saying about what's the things that have meant this hasn't happened, well, failure to transfer the funds is the fundamental one. That we've talked about it, and largely enthusiastic individual nurses or teams or PCTs or whatever was running it, they have done this stuff on the grounds of building better services and expanding nurses' roles, which many of the nurses are keen on doing. But then they hit the outer wall, which is, we can't keep taking stuff on. But that's where skill mix gets interesting as well, because there are some things that can be moved away. And again, I've talked some very traditional services where the highly skilled and qualified community nurses have actually been going about doing everything. Whereas in another place, they would have said, no, actually the healthcare assistant could do some of those things, and community staff nurses would do some of the others, and then we these people can be doing the IVs three times a day. That basically is like having a personal nurse. Because of the amount of time it takes. You can only free that up if you've also got a team. So skill mix per se is of course not a problem. It's not a wrong thing.
It's
having the right person, the right skills.
And having it 24 hours as well.
Yes.
That's another sort of like making sure that that you have the same care and the right people 24 hours a day, not just during the day and at night. And that's another resource issue as well, because of the out-of-hours services as well.
But sometimes it's also a sort of mindset issue, that one, isn't it? Mm. And you know, if people think community services are going to be 9 to 5 or maybe till 11 or whatever the thing is, and I want to work in them because of that, there have been places where they've introduced shift working to cover the night, and the existing workforce have really, really not liked it. You can understand that. None of us would quite like to suddenly be told we're going to work the night. It's difficult.
Yes.
But actually, we need, again, that mindset change that says it's 24 hour. And like lots of the machines in the hospital, you know, can't believe these really expensive things that only work between 9 and 5. And nobody sees that there should be a need for it to work at other times. That's how I was really impressed to have an MRI scan at 9 o'clock at night. I thought they'd got the time wrong. I thought they meant AM, but no, 9 o'clock they said, and 9 o'clock it was. You know, and that's getting the use out of it. Well, the same with the team. And equally, unless we can, as it were, promise the patient and promise the commissioners that that service will be there continuously for patients, of course they're not going to transfer and say, well, let's shut, you know, X ward or X service in the hospital because it can be done in the community. Not if they say at 5 o'clock on a Friday, well, sorry, see you on Monday. You know, it's absolutely got to happen, but that is a big deal. It's a huge thing to do. Anything else? If not, we will stop. I'm not waiting for hanging on for 15 minutes.
Is there anywhere that you know of that does work very well with sort of like care at home run by the sort of acute services that the money has followed in and it works sort of like well, or is it still sort of in its infancy, so to speak?
Some of it is still quite early. Oh, maybe you've got a volunteer here.
We've set up a programme at North Lee called TREAT. It's only Monday to Friday service so far. There is an issue about whether this is cost effective, but we've got money for a year, where we send patients that come into A&E that are elderly patients over a certain age, that would be better care. They're assessed by a doctor and a nurse, and that doctor and a nurse kind of take them home.
Mm-hmm.
So they go back to where they came from with the support from an acute nurse that may go to the nursing home, that may do X, Y, Z, give IVs. But it's only a Monday to Friday service,
right.
And it's something that what we're finding, and we still find, is that a lot of the elderly patients in A&E are the longest to be seen, etc. So this is a Monday to Friday service that we work with urgent care, which is, so we have a GP in the A&E, and then we set up this doctor-nurse service that actually try and take elderly patients back into the community. So, and that's what patients want, and it's been really well evaluated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the issue is around the cost, and I think a lot of the discussion that we've had today of what's happened over the years, for me as well, it's because there's so many community combined, you know, working in acute trust, for example, my background's renal, and, you know, with the social services aspects of that, trying to negotiate prices and care with multiple commissioners in London. We're one hospital, but we have to, our community consists of Enfield, Camden, any patient that comes out of Borough, they have a different style of doing things, different price, everything. So it makes it all very complicated, and it's never going to work because everybody wants to be slightly differently. And I think that's the barriers. But I think that there's a lot of, because hospitals are getting smaller, there are a lot of skills of acute nurses that are transferable into the community. And what I would like to see is that interchange between community and acute nurses and a team.
Mm.
So the fact that IV therapy, it would be as easy for nurses coming from the acute sector to go to patients' home and give IV therapy as part of a bigger IV therapy team. But I think the issue is the money and where that money comes from. And maybe it should still sit in acute sector and be divided out. But example, the services I manage, renal and liver services, I'm creating more clinical nurse specialist posts as opposed to decreasing them, because we are putting clinical nurse specialists in our dialysis units so that when patients come in that want to start and want to monitor their renal function, they're seen by a nurse as opposed to a doctor. Because it's on multiple sites, closer to home, my CNS budget has increased, it's not decreased.
Mm.
So there's a lot of issue about, you know, de-skilling nurses and reducing the amount of nurses, but I think that it may cost more money in the short term,
mm.
but I think the long-term benefits
mm.
of keeping patients that want to die at home, want to be cared at home, most of us would want to be, whatever age you were, you'd rather be at home than you would be in hospital.
Mm.
But I think it's the initial, because I don't think it's cheaper, but
yeah.
I think it's better quality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the argument.
Mm. And I suppose the big sort of elephant in the room thing is that ultimately what makes it cheaper is when we do away with the excess provision of hospitals.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And particularly, I mean, London is an example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody says there are too many hospitals.
Yeah.
And if you want to save big bucks and really change things and actually have money to invest in having brilliant community services, then you are going to have to tackle that issue. Because we've grown up with an NHS that was actually focused on hospitals. From its beginning, we kind of lost our way. It's interesting, the history, I love the history of the Q&I and going back over healthcare. But way back in the beginning, the people we trained were district nurses, health visitors and midwives in one. You know, they were trained to do everything, which is a model that's kind of coming around again, people talk about doing it. And everything was community-based. And they did terrific things at home, and as they were saying about the birth rate at home and so on. And the minute the NHS came along, somehow we the focus was on hospitals. And for years after, I would say, the focus was about the hospital as the centre of excellence, of learning and teaching and research, and that was quite right. But we absolutely lost community services. They got very invisible. And we're now suddenly, almost, we're saying, actually, we've decided community's where we're now, let's stick it all there. But it's hard to make that happen quickly. Politically, it needs to. Financially, it needs to. But there's an awful lot more to it, as we're saying. Than that, including the public's devotion to hospitals, for example. There was a place in down south somewhere where they had a big consultation because they wanted to close an ancient, very inadequate Victorian community hospital. And they were going to put the money into nursing teams who would come and see you at home and nurse you at home instead. Sounds wonderful. Big outcry, public stopped it, they wanted to save the hospital. You know, the fundamental devotion to a hospital and the fundamental belief that nursing in the home is not going to be as good. That it's something we've really got to tackle. And I honestly think that is in the heads of some politicians, many, quite a lot of people who work in the acute sector who seriously do see that care outside of the acute is somehow stepped down. It's less skilled.
I think a lot
and
of
the patients who think that.
A lot of those fears are around what you were saying, though. It's not available 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they want their A&Es.
And
they
you'd be right to be afraid.
To
yeah.
up and
mm.
just be able to go there and...
Yeah.
and
or pick up a phone at night and know that it's going to get somebody qualified at the end of the line who can
yes.
deal with what their exacerbation from a COPD exacerbation or something like that. And they know that they're going to get the gym, rather than picking the phone up and dialing 999 and going to hospital. Because
sorry,
that's what happens.
But don't you think that a patient is on a pathway and the acute side and the community side should be a whole pathway.
Yeah.
Sort of one part.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I was very fortunate to go to America with the King's Fund to look at the healthcare pathways. And we all know in America about the insurance and how Americans have to pay and its numbers of days in hospital, it's what your insurance covers. But because of the money, and I don't agree with the money concept, by the way, but because of that, when anybody going in for elective procedure or got a chronic disease, their care was planned, very, very planned because of the
mm-hmm.
cost.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a chronic patient and you had an exacerbation of COPD, you knew exactly when you were going to hospital, why you were going into hospital, what for, how
mm-hmm.
many days,
mm-hmm.
and what would happen afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a continuous
mm-hmm.
flow
mm-hmm.
of in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were a surgical patient that needed a surgical procedure and that you needed to follow up like antibiotics or a warfarin check, that was already pre-planned. So it was a continuation
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
of the money followed the patient,
mm-hmm.
etc. And that as a concept,
mm-hmm.
I think I've always agreed with,
mm.
but it's led financially, which I don't necessarily agree with, but that streamline of
mm.
interconnection between hospital and community, I think that everybody can help. help each other out.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's about the patient.
Mm.
And sometimes you may be in hospital, sometimes you may be community. So why can't it all be joined together?
Yeah.
And I think there is still that divide between the hospital and the
yes, I know. And,
yeah.
And
it
always has been.
Hopefully
it
will get better.
Yeah.
But it's still quite a big
And I think the other thing is, it's not just the fact it's not 24 hours. You've got to have the nurses with their skills.
That's
they've got to have advanced skills.
Yeah.
They've got to be able to prescribe, because they've got to be able to make that difference. And we found in our trust that even giving the band 5s some more advanced assessment skills help, because you need, when you've got acute people at home, you do need a different set of skills than you would have perhaps with normal.
Exactly.
You know,
which is why we're not saying, you know, the Q&I is not saying we must restore district nurses like they used to be, because actually you need a different set of skills today.
Yeah.
And Rathbone would turn into grave, you know, if we were trying to save the old thing. No, it's got to be the skills that match what's required today. But you're right, I mean, the integration and getting those pathways genuinely connected is A, very difficult, because we have got, there's a big wall between the two still. We're trying, and people are trying to commission on that basis. They're trying to, the NICE guidelines tend to take people across the parliament. Circling right back to the very first thing we heard with Peter Carter talking about the bill, that's the real clever trick. Whatever else they do with the bill, tell us how you make competition between providers and purchaser provider system work with integration.
Mm-hmm.
If you can make it work, then let's do it, because that is the fundamental issue that we've got to solve, because we don't have a fully integrated service. And if we had a nice, smooth, running pathway, of course you could push more people to the community end and pull them out of the hospital end. But at the moment, you kind of feel they're pulling out and they might fall off a cliff. And that's not good for them, it's not good for the service, you know, it's wrong. So we've got to have this good connection. And say, I do think one of the issues at the moment is there's great stuff going on in the community, but it's very fragmented, it's very different, it's very idiosyncratic, it's chance whether you find it. And that we need to address as well. It shouldn't be. You should get the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we'll keep working on. Right.
Well,
thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much for coming in and staying.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.